You're listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of Rudolf Steiner's Introductions to Goethe's Scientific Writings, entitled Nature's Open Secret. This is Chapter 3, entitled The Origin of Goethe's Thinking on Animal Morphology. Lavater's title Essays on Physiognomy was published in 1775 to 1778. Footnote: Physiognomische Fragmente zur Beförderung der Menschenkenntnis und Menschenliebe. Physiognomic Fragments to Advance Human Knowledge and Human Love. Johann Caspar Lavater, 1741 to 1801, Swiss mystic, poet, philosopher, dramatist, and clergyman. Editor, end of footnote. Goethe took a lively interest in this work, not only as director of its publication, but also as a contributing author. Of particular interest to us now, however, is that in these contributions we find the seeds of his later zoological works. Physiognomy sought to determine the inner nature or spirit of people through their external form. Form was considered not for its own sake, but as an expression of the soul. Goethe's sculptural spirit, as though created to grasp things in their outer formal relationships, was not to be limited to this approach. While engaged in these studies, that approach the outer form only as a way to know the inner being, Goethe came to realize the independent significance of form in its own right. This can be seen in his 1776 studies of animal skulls, which we find inserted into part 2 of the second volume of title Essays on Physiognomy. He was stimulated to begin these studies that year by reading Aristotle on physiognomy. He also attempted to examine the difference between human beings and animals. Goethe found this difference in the way the structure of the human form as a whole gives rise to the preeminence of the head in the highly developed human brain, toward which all parts of the body point as their center. Quote, "How the whole human figure stands there as the supporting column of the dome in which the heavens are to be reflected." Close quote. In the structure of the animal, he found the opposite. Quote, "The head only appended to the spinal column, the brain, the end of the spinal cord, has no greater compass than necessary for expressing the animal spirits and for directing a creature that lives through its senses in the immediate present." Close quote. With these indications, Goethe went beyond the consideration of individual interrelationships between the outer and inner nature of the human being, to a grasp of a comprehensive whole, and to the contemplation of the form as such. He came to view the whole of the human form as the basis for the higher expressions of human life. And in the particular character of that whole, he recognized the precondition that places the human being at the pinnacle of creation. In forming this concept, we must keep in mind that Goethe sought to relate the animal shapes to the fully developed human form. But in the animals, the organs that serve primarily the animal functions predominate, as it were, and become the point toward which their entire organization is directed and which it serves. Whereas the human organism develops those organs in particular that serve spiritual functions. Even at this early stage, we find that what Goethe envisioned as the animal organism is no longer any particular one, as we find it in sensory reality. It is, rather, an ideal organism that develops more toward a lower aspect of its nature in the animals and toward a higher aspect in the human being. Here lies the seed of what Goethe later called the type, by which he did not intend, quote, any particular animal, close quote, but the idea of the animal. Yes, and more. We find here intimations of a law that he formulated later and that has significant implications, namely that, quote, "diversity of form springs from a preponderance of one part over the others. Close quote. Indeed, the contrast between the animals and the human being is already seen here as arising through the development of an ideal form in two diverging directions, whereby different systems of organs gain a preponderance and give the entire creature its particular character. In the same year, 1776, we also find that Goethe became clear about a way of approaching the forms of animal organisms. He realized that the bones are the foundations of the form, a thought he later upheld in his anatomical studies, in which he always proceeded from osteology. In that year he wrote the pertinent sentence, quote, "The mobile parts form according to them the bones, or better, with them, and play their own role only to the extent that the solid parts allow." Close quote. And another indication in Lavater's Physiognomy, quote, "It may already have been noticed that I consider the skeletal system to be the basic sketch of the human being, the skull to be the foundation of the skeletal system, and all fleshy parts to be scarcely more than the coloration of this drawing." Close quote. This was probably inspired by Goethe, who often discussed these things with Lavater. Such views are indeed identical with Goethe's, but Goethe now makes a further observation that we must consider. Quote, "This comment, that by studying the bones, and especially the skull, one can see most clearly how the skeleton is the foundation of the form, will encounter considerable opposition when applied to the dissimilarity of human skulls, though it is indisputable here in animals." Close quote. What is Goethe doing here but looking for the simpler animal in the composite human being, as he later put it in 1795? Footnote, in the section, quote, "The Purpose Set Forth," close quote, of his essay, quote, "On Morphology," quote, Goethe sheds light on this statement, quote, "The more imperfect a creature is, the more its parts appear identical or similar to each other, and the more they resemble the whole. The more perfected the creature is, the more dissimilar its parts become. In the first case, the whole is more or less identical to its parts. In the second case, the whole is dissimilar to its parts. The more similar the parts, the less they will be subordinated to each other. Subordination of the parts betokens a more perfected creature." Compare also to the statement of Herder, quoted on page 28, editor, end of footnote. This leads us to conclude that Goethe established the fundamental concepts upon which he based his later thoughts on animal morphology through his preoccupation with Lavater's Physiognomy in 1776. This was also the year that Goethe began to study anatomy in detail. On January 22, 1776, he wrote to Lavater, quote, "The Duke had 6 skulls sent to me. I have made glorious observations, which are available to you if you haven't already made them without me." Close quote. Goethe's connections with the University of Jena further stimulated his study of anatomy. Our first indications of this are from 1781. In a diary edited by Keil on October 15, 1781, Goethe noted that he went to Jena with, quote, "old Einsiedel," close quote, and busied himself with anatomy. At Jena there was a scholar named Loder who advanced Goethe's studies tremendously. It was he who also led Goethe further into the field of anatomy, as he wrote to Frau von Stein on October 29th and to Karl August on November 4th. Footnote 3, quote, "A troublesome labor of love that I have undertaken leads me further in my pursuit. Loder is explaining to me all the bones and muscles, and I shall understand a great deal in a few days." Quote, close quote, Grosteiner. End of footnote. In the second letter, he spoke of his intention, quote, "to explain the sketches to the young people of the art academy, and to lead them to a knowledge of the human body. I am doing this both for my sake and for theirs. The method I have chosen will familiarize them completely with the fundamentals of the body over the course of this winter." Close quote. Footnote, quote, "He, Loder, has demonstrated to me osteology and myology in 8 days, which we have devoted almost entirely to this, to the extent that my attentiveness held out." Close quote. Rudolf Steiner, end of footnote. Goethe's diary entries show that he actually gave these lectures, ending them on January 16, 1782. At the same time, there must have been a good deal of discussion with Loder about the structure of the human body. On January 6th, Goethe's diary notes, quote, "Demonstration of the Heart by Loder," close quote. We have seen that as early as 1776, Goethe harbored far-sighted thoughts on the structure of animal organisms. Thus, there can be no doubt at all that his intensive preoccupation with anatomy at this later time raised itself beyond details to higher perspectives. He wrote to Lavater and Merck on November 14, 1781, that he was treating, quote, "the bones as a text to which all life and everything human can be appended," close quote. When we read a text, pictures and ideas form in our mind that seem to be evoked or created by the text. Goethe treated the bones as such a text. That is, while he observed them, thoughts arose within him concerning all of life and everything human. In the course of these contemplations, certain ideas on the formation of the organism must have made an impression on him. Goethe's ode of 1782, quote, "the divine," close quote, can help us understand to some degree his thinking at the time on the relationship of the human being to the rest of nature. The first verse reads, quote, "Let us be noble, helpful, and good, for this alone distinguishes us from all the beings that we know," close quote. Having characterized the spiritual attributes of the human being in the first 2 lines of this verse, Goethe asserts that these alone distinguish us from all the other beings in the world. This alone shows us very clearly that Goethe considered the physical constitution of the human being to conform entirely with the rest of nature. The thought we drew attention to earlier was growing more and more alive within him, that one basic form governs both human and animal shapes, but that, in the human, it attains such perfection that it becomes the vehicle for free spiritual beings. With regard to our sense-perceptible characteristics, as human beings we must also, as the ode says, quote, "complete the circles of our existence according to eternal laws of mighty iron necessity," close quote. But in our case, these laws develop in a way that allows us to do the impossible, quote, "we distinguish, choose, and judge, and to the moment give permanent form," close quote. We must also bear in mind that while Goethe's views were becoming more and more definite, he was in lively communication with Herder, who in 1783 was beginning to formulate his title, Reflections on the Philosophy of the History of Humanity. This work might almost be said to have arisen from those two men's discussions, and many of its ideas may well be traced to Goethe. The thoughts expressed there are often entirely Goethean, but phrased in Herder's style, so that we can draw from them a reliable conclusion about Goethe's thought at that time. In the first part of his work, Herder develops the following view of the natural world. We must presuppose a principal form that moves through all beings and realizes itself in various ways. Quote, "from the stone to the crystal, from the crystal to the metals, from these to the creation of plants, from plants to animals, from these to the human being. We saw the organizational form ascend, and with it the forces and drives of this creature grow more versatile and finally unite in the form of the human being to the extent that it can encompass them." Close quote. This thought is perfectly clear, an ideal, typical form that as such has no sensory reality, realizes itself in an endless multiplicity of spatially separated and qualitatively differentiated beings, all the way up to the human being. On the lower levels of organization, it always realizes itself in a particular direction and develops toward it in a very pronounced way. As this typical form rises toward the human being, it gathers all the formative principles developed in a one-sided way in the lower organisms, which it distributed among various beings, into one form. This creates the possibility of such high perfection in a human being. Here, nature has bestowed upon one being what she dispersed among many classes and orders of animals. This thought had an uncommonly fruitful effect on subsequent German philosophy. To further clarify this concept, let us quote here its later formulation by Auchin. Quote, "The animal kingdom is only one animal. In other words, it represents animality in such a way that each of its organs exists as a whole in itself. An individual animal comes into existence when an individual organ separates from the general animal body, while, nevertheless, accomplishing the essential animal functions. The animal kingdom is merely the dismembered highest animal, the human being. There is only one human kind, one human race, one human species, for the simple reason that the human being is the entire animal kingdom." From Lehrbuch der Naturphilosophie, Jena, 1831, close quote. Thus there are, for example, animals in whom the organs of touch are developed, whose whole organization, in fact, is oriented toward touching, in which it finds its goal. There are others in which the organs for eating are especially developed, and so on. In other words, within each species of animal, one organ system becomes prominent in a one-sided way. The whole animal is entirely immersed in it, and all else recedes into the background. In the formation of the human being, however, all organs and organ systems develop in such a way that each leaves the others enough room to develop freely. Each withdraws enough to allow all the others to likewise come into their own. Thus, an harmonious interaction of the individual organs and systems arises, creating a harmony that makes the human the most perfect of beings, uniting the perfections of all the other creatures. These thoughts comprised the substance of Goethe's conversations with Herder, who expressed them in this way, quote, "The human race can be seen as the great confluence of lower organic forces that gather to achieve humanity. Thus we can assume that the human being is a central creature among animals, that is, the finished form in which the characteristics of all the various species are assembled in their finest essence." Close quote. Footnote, Herder, title Reflections on the Philosophy of the History of Humanity, Book 5, Part 1, or Book 2, Part 1, Rudolf Steiner. End of footnote. The following passage from Goethe's letter to Knebel, December 8, 1783, indicates the extent of Goethe's participation in Herder's title Reflections on the Philosophy of the History of Humanity. Quote, "Herder is writing a philosophy of history, new from the ground up, as you can imagine. The day before yesterday we read the first chapters together. They are delightful. World history and natural history are simply raging along with us now." Close quote. Footnote. Compare letter of Frau von Stein to Knebel on page 12, editor. End of footnote. Herder's observation that the upright posture inherent in the human organism and everything connected with it is the fundamental precondition for human thinking is directly reminiscent of Goethe's above-mentioned indications of 1776 concerning the generic difference between the human being and the animals, parenthesis in Lavater's title Essays on Physiognomy, close parenthesis. Okay, I have two footnotes here, one Okay, never mind that one. It's just reference to some book things. Second footnote, Essays on Physiognomy, Volume 2, Section 2. See also page 22 of the present volume. Editor, end of footnotes. Herder's expositions are only one formulation of this thought. All of this justifies our assumption, however, that Goethe and Herder essentially agreed at the time, 1783, on the place of the human being in nature. Now, one of the consequences of such a basic view is that each organ or part of an animal will be found also in the human being, but restrained within the limits imposed by the harmony of the whole. A particular bone, for example, must in fact develop in a certain way in a particular animal species in which it will predominate. But it must also be at least indicated in all other animals, and it must not be absent in human beings. Whereas in the animal it assumes the form that corresponds to its own lawfulness, in the human being it must acquiesce to the whole and adapt its formative laws to those of the organism as a whole. If nature's web is not to tear, however, it cannot be absent entirely, since this would disturb the consistent elaboration of the type. These were Goethe's views when he suddenly became aware of an opinion that completely contradicted this great thought. The scholars of that time were concerned primarily with finding the traits that distinguish one animal species from another. It was believed that the difference between animals and human beings was that animals have a little bone, the intermaxillary, located between the two symmetrical halves of their upper jaw and holding the upper incisors. This bone was thought to be absent in human beings. In 1782, Merck was beginning to take a lively interest in osteology and turned to some of the most prominent scholars at that time for help. Footnote, Johann Heinrich Merck, 1741 to 1791, a German critic, writer and critic who helped to promote the Sturm und Drang movement. Merck, a friend of Goethe, funded the publication of his tragic play Götz von Berlichingen, 1773, the success of which established the Shakespearean form of drama in Germany. Editor, end of footnote. On October 8, 1782, the distinguished anatomist Sommering responded with information regarding the difference between animals and human beings. Footnote first. Samuel Thomas von Sommering, 1755 to 1830, anatomist and professor in Kassel, established the number and names of the cranial nerves, as well as other neuroanatomical discoveries. Editor, end of footnote. Now a quote from him. I wish you would look into Blumenbach on the subject of the ossus intermaxillaris. Footnote. Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, 1752 to 1840, German zoologist and anthropologist and professor of medicine at Göttingen. He was among the first to study humankind as a species and was considered the founder of modern anthropology. He pioneered craniology and was the first to classify human beings as Caucasian, Mongolian, Ethiopian, American, and Malayan. Editor and a footnote continue with quote of Sommering. All other things being equal, it is the only bone, found in all animals from the ape up, including the orangutan, but is never found in the human being. With the exception of this bone, there is nothing that prevents you from transferring everything found in the human being to the animals. I am, therefore, providing you with the head of a doe in order to convince you that this os intermaxillar, as Blumenbach calls it, or os incisivum, according to Camper, is present even in animals with no incisors in their upper jaw. Close quote. Although Blumenbach found rudimentary traces of the ossus intermaxillaris in the skulls of unborn or young children, indeed in one such skull even two entirely separate little kernels of bone as actual intermaxillary bones, he nevertheless refused to admit its existence. He said, quote, there is still a world of difference between this and the true ossa intermaxillari. Close quote. Camper, the most famous anatomist of the time, shared this opinion. Footnote, Peter Camper, 1722 to 1786, Dutch anatomist and professor in Franeker and Amsterdam, was known for his work in human comparative anatomy and in surgery and obstetrics. He tried to determine the degree of human intelligence by measuring the facial angle. Editor, end of footnote. He referred, for example, to the intermaxillary bone as having, quote, never been found in the human being, close quote. Merck had the greatest admiration for Camper and occupied himself with his writings. Merck, as well as Blumenbach and Zollmering, were in communication with Goethe. Goethe's correspondence with Merck shows that he took the liveliest interest in his osteological research and exchanged ideas with him on the subject. On October 27, 1782, he asked Merck to write something for him about Camper's incognitum, unknown animal, and to send him Camper's letters. Furthermore, we should note a visit by Blumenbach in Weimar in April 1783. In September of the same year, Goethe went to Göttingen in order to visit Blumenbach and all the professors. On September 28th, he wrote to Frau von Stein, quote, I have decided to visit all the professors, and you can imagine how much running that will mean if I am to make the rounds in a few days. Close quote. He then went to Kassel, where he met with Forster and Zollmering. From there he wrote to Frau von Stein on October 2nd, quote, I am seeing very beautiful and good things, and being rewarded for my quiet industriousness. Most fortunate of all is the fact that I can say now that I am on the right track, and that from now on nothing will be lost on me. Close quote. It was probably during this interchange that Goethe first learned of the prevailing view regarding the intermaxillary. In his view of matters, this immediately seemed to be an error. It would destroy the typical, fundamental form according to which all organisms must be fashioned. Goethe could not doubt that this member, found in various stages of development in all higher animals, must also take part in the structuring of the human form, and recedes here only because the alimentary organs as a whole recede before those that serve spiritual functions. Because of his whole inner orientation, Goethe could not help thinking that there must be an intermaxillary bone in the human being as well. It would only be a question of proving it empirically by investigating its form in human beings and the extent of its adaptation to the human organism as a whole. In the spring of 1784, together with Loder, with whom he compared human and animal skulls in Jena, Goethe succeeded in finding that proof. On March 27th, he announced his discovery to both Frau von Stein and Herder. Footnote 14, quote, It is a rare pleasure. I have made an anatomical discovery that is significant and beautiful. Close quote, Rudolf Steiner, and this is from a letter to Frau von Stein. 15, letter to Herder, quote, I have found neither gold nor silver, but something that gives me unspeakable joy, the human ossus intermaxillaris. Close quote, Rudolf Steiner, footnote, end of footnote. We should not overestimate this single discovery in weighing it against the great thoughts upon which it was based. Its value for Goethe lay simply in clearing away a preconception that seemed to obstruct a consistent pursuit of his ideas right into the smallest detail of an organism. Neither did Goethe view this as an isolated discovery, but always saw it in relation to his larger view of nature. Thus, this is how we should understand Goethe when he wrote to Herder in his letter, quote, It should greatly please you, because it is like the keystone to the human being. It is not missing. It is there as well. But how? Close quote. And he immediately reminded his friend of other perspectives. Quote, I have also thought of it in relation to your whole picture. How beautiful it will be there. Close quote. To Goethe it was meaningless to argue that animals have an intermaxillary bone, but that human beings do not. if the forces that form the organism insert an inner maxillary between the two upper jawbones in animals, then these same forces must also be active in human beings, in a location that corresponds to where that bone is found in animals, in essentially the same way, but with a different outer expression. Goethe never thought of the organism as a dead, fixed assembly, but one that constantly arises from inner formative forces. Consequently, he had to ask, what are those forces doing in the human upper jaw? He could not ask whether or not the intermaxillary is present, but rather only seek to determine its characteristics and form. This had to be done empirically. As various of his statements show, the thought of writing a more comprehensive work on nature now began to stir in Goethe with increasing vitality. Thus, when sending Knebel his treatise on his discovery in November 1784, Goethe wrote to him, quote, "I have refrained from calling attention at this time to the conclusion, which Herder has already alluded to in his reflections, that the difference between the human being and the animals cannot be found in any particular." Close quote. The most important thing here is that Goethe says he has refrained from calling attention to this fundamental thought at this time. He thus intended to do so later, within a larger context. Furthermore, this statement shows that the fundamental thoughts most interesting to us, Goethe's great ideas about the animal type, were alive in his mind long before that discovery. Here, Goethe admits that they were suggested in Herder's reflections, and the passages in which this occurs were written before the discovery of the intermaxillary bone. The discovery of the intermaxillary is, therefore, only a result of these far-reaching views. To those who did not hold such views, the discovery must have remained incomprehensible. They had been deprived of the single feature in natural history that could distinguish the human being from the animals. They had hardly an inkling of Goethe's prevailing view, that elements distributed among the animals unite harmoniously in the single human form, thus establishing, despite the identity of all particulars, a differentiation of the whole that gives humankind its high rank in nature's hierarchy. Their way of observing was not through ideas, but by external comparison, for which the intermaxillary, in fact, did not exist in the human being. They had little understanding for what Goethe demanded, that is, seeing with the eyes of the spirit. This was also the reason for the difference in judgment between them and Goethe. Whereas Blumenbach, who also saw the matter very clearly, concluded that, quote, "there is a world of difference between it and the true ossa intermaxillari," close quote, Goethe judged the matter by asking, how can such an external difference, no matter how great, be explained when there is a necessary inner identity? Goethe now clearly wanted to elaborate this thought in a consistent way, and he occupied himself with it a great deal during the following years. On May 1st, 1784, Frau von Stein wrote to Knebel, quote, "Herder's new work makes it seem likely that we were originally plants and animals. Goethe is now pondering these things very thoughtfully, and everything that goes through his mind becomes extremely interesting." Close quote. Footnote. The statement was quoted in another context on page 12. See also Goethe's comment to Knebel on page 28. Editor. End of footnote. Goethe longed to present his views on nature in a major work, and the intensity of that desire can be seen vividly in the strength with which, with each new discovery, he emphatically told his friends about the possibility of expanding his ideas to embrace all of nature. In 1786 he wrote to Frau von Stein of his wish to expand, quote, "to all the kingdoms of nature, to her whole kingdom," close quote, his ideas on how nature produces her manifold life by playing, as it were, with one primary form. And in Italy, when the concept of metamorphosis in the plant world stood before his spirit with sculptural clarity, right down into every detail, he wrote in Naples on May 17, 1787, quote, "It will be possible to apply the same law to all living things," Close quote. The first essay in his titled Morphological Notebooks, 1817, contains the words, quote, thus, what in my youthful enthusiasm I often dreamt of as a completed work now presents itself as a draft, as a fragmentary collection. Close quote. We must regret that such a work never flowed from Goethe's pen. Judging by all that we do have, such a production would have far surpassed anything of its kind achieved in recent times. It would have become the standard body of principles from which every scientific endeavor would have had to proceed, and against which we could weigh its spiritual substance. The most profound philosophical spirit, parenthesis, which only a superficial mind fails to see in Goethe, close parenthesis, would have been united there with loving immersion in what is given through sensory experience. Far from a one-sided obsession with systems claiming to encompass all things in one general scheme, his work would have done justice to every single individual. Here we would have had to work of the work of a mind that never favors one area of human endeavor at the expense of all the others, but for which, even while devoted to a single subject, the whole of human existence is always present in the background. In this way, each individual activity takes its rightful place in relation to the whole. When the mind objectively immerses itself in the contemplated objects, it enters them fully. Thus Goethe's theories do not appear as though abstracted from objects, but rather as though they were formed by the objects themselves in a mind that forgets itself in contemplation. This strictest objectivity would make Goethe's work the most perfect of scientific works, an ideal toward which every scientist would have to strive. For philosophers, it would be an archetypal model for discovering the laws of objective world contemplation. We can assume that epistemology, now arising everywhere as a philosophical foundation of science, will not become fruitful until it makes Goethe's way of observing and thinking its point of reference. In the title Annals of 1790, Goethe himself gave the reason why this work never came about. Quote, the task was so great that it could not be resolved in a single distracted lifetime. Close quote. From this point of view, the available fragments of Goethe's scientific work assume tremendous significance. Indeed, we will never value and understand them properly until we see how they arose from that greater whole. In 1784, however, the treatise on the inner maxillary bone was to be formulated merely as a preliminary exercise, so to speak. To begin with, it was not intended to be published. As Goethe wrote to Sommering, March 6, 1785, quote, since my little treatise has no claim whatever to publicity, and should be regarded as merely a first draft, I would be pleased to hear whatever you might wish to share with me on this subject. Close quote. The project was, nevertheless, accomplished with great care and with all the necessary individual studies. Some young people were immediately enlisted to help make drawings, under Goethe's guidance, according to Comper's method. On April 23, 1784, Goethe therefore asked Merck for information on this method, and had Sommering send him drawings in Comper's style. Merck, Sommering, and other acquaintances were asked for all kinds of skeletons and bones. On April 23rd, Goethe wrote to Merck that he would be very pleased to have the following skeletons: a Myrmecophagus, South American anteater, Bradipus, sloth, lions and tigers, or similar skeletons. Close quote. On May 14th, he asked Sommering for the skull of his elephant skeleton and that of a hippopotamus, and on September 16th, for the skulls of the following animals, quote, wild cat, lion, young bear, incognitum, anteater, camel, dromedary, and sea lion. Close quote. Particular items of information were also requested from his friends. From Merck, a description of the palate of his rhinoceros, particularly an explanation of, quote, how the horn of the rhinoceros is actually seated on the nasal bone. Close quote. Goethe was utterly absorbed in these studies. Weitz drew the elephant skull from many sides according to Comper's method, and when Goethe discovered that most of the sutures in this skull were not yet grown together, he compared it with a large skull in his own possession, and with other skulls. While studying this skull, he made an important observation. It had been assumed previously that in all animals only the incisors were embedded in the inner maxillary, whereas the canine teeth belonged to the upper jawbone. The only exception was thought to be the elephant, in which the canines were supposedly contained in the inner maxillary. That this is not the case was now also demonstrated to Goethe by this skull, which he wrote of in a letter to Herder. Goethe's osteological studies accompanied him that summer on a journey to Eisenach and Braunschweig. While in Braunschweig, he intended to, quote, look into the mouth of an unborn elephant and carry on a hearty conversation with Zimmermann, close quote. He wrote further about this fetus to Merck, close quote, I wish we had in our own cabinet the fetus that they have in Braunschweig. It would be quickly dissected, skeletonized, and prepared. I do not know what such a monstrosity in alcohol is good for, if it is not dismembered and its inner structure explained. Close quote. These studies led to a treatise, included in Volume 1 of Goethe's scientific works in Kirchner's National Literature. Footnote, quote, an intermaxillary bone is present in the upper jaw of man as well as in animals, close quote. An English translation of this treatise is included in title Goethe Scientific Studies, Zurkamp, edition, page 111, and that's the editor. And another footnote right after that. The volume mentioned here, the Kirchner National Literature volume, was introduced by the essays of Rudolf Steiner that comprise chapters 1 through 4 of this book. Editor, end of footnote. Loder was very helpful to Goethe in composing this treatise, and Latin terminology was introduced with his assistance. He also prepared a Latin translation. In November 1784, Goethe sent the treatise to Knebel and, on December 19th, to Merck, though shortly before, December 2nd, he had doubted that much would come of it before the year's end. The work was accompanied by the necessary drawings, and for Comper's sake, by the Latin translation. Merck was to send the work to Sommering, who received it in January 1785. From there, it went to Comper. If we now look at how Goethe's treatise was received, we are faced with a rather unpleasant picture. Initially, no one had the capacity to understand it, with the exception of Loder, with whom Goethe had worked, and Herder. Merck took pleasure in the treatise, but was not convinced that its assertions were true. Sommering wrote to inform Merck of its arrival. Quote, Blumenbach already had the main idea. He, Goethe, begins one paragraph saying, quote, there can therefore be no doubt, since the rest of them, the sutures, grow together, close quote. The only problem is that they never existed. This is a continuation of the quote. I have before me now the jawbones of embryos ranging from 3 months to maturity, and not one of them contains a suture that can be seen toward the front. And to explain it through the pressure of the bones against one another? Indeed, as though nature worked like a carpenter with hammer and wedges. Close quote. On February 13th, 1785, Goethe wrote to Merck, quote, I received a very thoughtless letter from Sommering. He actually wants to talk me out of it. Oh, close quote. And Sommering wrote to Merck on May 11th, 1785, quote, I see from Goethe's letter of yesterday that he is not ready to abandon his idea concerning the ossus intermaxillaris, close quote. And now Comper. On September 16th, 1785, he reported to Merck that the accompanying illustrations were certainly not drawn according to his method. He even found them quite faulty. He praised the outer appearance of the beautiful manuscript, but criticized the Latin translation and even suggested that the author brush up on his Latin. 3 days later he wrote that he had made a number of observations on the intermaxillary, but must continue to maintain that there is no such bone in the human being. He conceded that all of Goethe's observations were correct, except those pertaining to the human being. And again on March 21, 1786, he wrote that based on numerous observations, he had concluded that the intermaxillary does not exist in the human being. Comper's letters show clearly that he was very willing to go into the matter, but that he was not at all capable of understanding Goethe. Loder immediately saw Goethe's discovery in the right light. He gave it a prominent place in his title Anatomical Handbook of 1788, and after that addressed it in all his writings as a fully accepted fact of science that could not be doubted. Herder wrote to Knebel that, quote, Goethe has presented us with his treatise on the bone, which is very simple and beautiful. This man travels the true path of nature, and fortune comes to meet him. Close quote. Herder was indeed capable of seeing the matter, as Goethe did, with his, quote, spiritual eye, E-Y-E, close quote. Without this capacity, there was no way of coming to terms with it. This can best be seen from the following, written by Wilhelm Josephi, instructor at the University of Göttingen, in his title Anatomy of Mammals, 1787, quote, the ossa intermaxillaria are considered one of the main characteristics that distinguish apes from human beings. Yet, according to my observations, human beings also have such ossa intermaxillaria, at least during the first months of life. But they usually grow together with the true upper jawbones, especially on the outside, at the very early stage, indeed, while still in the mother's womb, so that often no noticeable trace of them remains. Close quote. Goethe's discovery is in fact fully confirmed here, although not as a consequence of the consistent elaboration of the type, but as an expression of what is directly visible to the eyes. If one relies only on the eyes, then of course it depends only on chance whether one happens to find specimens in which one actually sees the matter with precision. But when one grasps the matter as Goethe did, through the idea, then these particular specimens only confirm the idea and openly reveal what nature otherwise conceals. But the idea itself can be traced in any specimen. Each reveals a particular instance of the idea. Indeed, when we possess the idea, then we can find through it just those examples in which it is most distinctly revealed. Without the idea, however, we are at the mercy of chance. It can, in fact, be seen that after Goethe had given the impetus through his great thought, the scientific community was gradually convinced of the truth of his discovery through the observation of numerous cases. Footnote, Goethe wrote, quote, an idea about objects of experience is, in a manner of speaking, an organ that I use in order to grasp them, in order to make them my own. Close quote. See page 270 of the accompanying essay. Editor, end of footnote. It seems that Merck continued to waver. On February 13, 1785, Goethe sent him a human upper jawbone that had been split apart, along with one from a manatee, and gave him clues as to how to understand them. It appears from Goethe's letter of April 8th that Merck had been more or less won over. But he soon changed his mind again, for on November 11, 1786, he wrote to Zumering, quote, I hear that Vic d'Azyr has actually included Goethe's so-called discovery in his book. Footnote, I'm afraid I can't read this word. Dr. Felix, then the word Vic, V-I-C-Q, and then the word small d apostrophe capital A-Z-Y-R. I'm going to say Dr. Felix Vic d'Azur, but sorry. 1748 to 1794, French neuroanatomist, whose treatises helped lay the foundation for neuroanatomy. He was one of the first to section the brain horizontally and created a classic anatomic folio of the brain. He identified many of the cerebral convolutions, as well as the deep gray nuclei of the cerebrum and basal ganglia. The mammalothalamic trait was also described by him and bears his name. Editor, end of footnote. Zumering gradually abandoned his opposition. In his work titled On the Structure of the Human Body, he stated, quote, Goethe's ingenious attempt in 1785 to demonstrate through comparative osteology that the intermaxillary bone of the upper jaw is found in the human being as well as other animals with its very accurate illustrations, deserves to be publicly known. Close quote. It was more difficult to win over Blumenbach. In his title Handbook of Comparative Anatomy, 1805, he maintained his conviction that human beings do not have an intermaxillary bone. In his essay titled Principles of Zoological Philosophy, from 1830 to 1832, Goethe was nevertheless able to speak of Blumenbach's conversion. After personal communication, he came over to Goethe's side. On December 15, 1825, he even provided Goethe with a beautiful example that confirmed his discovery. A Hessian athlete sought help from Blumenbach's colleague Langenbeck for an, quote, os intermaxillar, quite animal-like in prominence, close quote. We shall speak further of later advocates of Goethe's ideas. Let us only add here that by using diluted nitric acid, M. J. Weber successfully separated the intermaxillary bone even after it had fused with the upper jawbone. Goethe continued his study of bones after finishing this treatise. His simultaneous discoveries in botany intensified his interest in nature. He was constantly borrowing relevant objects from his friends. On December 7, 1785, Zumering became angry, quote, that Goethe had not returned his heads, close quote. From Goethe's letter to Zumering, June 8, 1786, we learn that he still had those skulls. Goethe's great ideas also went with him to Italy. While the thought of the archetypal plant took shape in his mind, he also developed concepts about the human form. In Rome, on January 20, 1787, Goethe wrote, quote, in anatomy, I am fairly well prepared, and have acquired a certain knowledge of the human body, though not without effort. Here, by endlessly contemplating statues, one's attention is continually drawn to the human body, but in a more elevated way. Our medical, surgical anatomy is concerned only with knowing the parts, and to this end a miserable muscle will do. In Rome, however, the parts mean nothing if they are not also part of a noble, beautiful form. In the great hospital of San Spirito, a very beautiful musculature model has been set up for artists in a way that fills one with admiration for its beauty. It could pass as a flayed demigod, a Marsyas. The custom here, following the ancients, is to study the skeleton not as an artificially arranged mass of bones, but with the ligaments attached, giving it life and movement. Close quote. Goethe was primarily seeking to acquaint himself with the laws according to which nature shapes organic, especially human, forms, the tendency she follows in forming them. Just as Goethe searched amid the multiplicity of innumerable plant forms for the archetypal plant, with which one can endlessly invent plants that are necessarily consistent, that accord perfectly with nature's tendency, and would exist if corresponding conditions arose, he was likewise intent on studying animals and the human being, quote, to discover ideal characters, close quote, that accord fully with the laws of nature. Soon after his return from Italy, Goethe became, quote, diligent in anatomicis, close quote, and in 1789 he wrote to Herder, quote, I have a newly discovered harmonium natura to present, close quote. His new discovery may have been part of his vertebral theory of the skull. The completion of this discovery, however, came in 1790. Before then he knew that all the bones that make up the back of the head represent three modified spinal vertebrae. Goethe conceived of the matter this way. The brain represents a mass of spinal cord material raised to the highest level of perfection. Whereas the nerves, serving primarily the lower organic functions, end in and branch out from the spinal cord, the nerves, serving the higher mental functions, primarily the sensory nerves, end and begin in the brain. What appears in the brain is simply the fully developed form of what is indicated, but latent, in the spinal cord. The brain is a fully developed spinal cord, the spinal cord an unelaborated brain. Now the vertebra of the spinal column are shaped in complete conformity with the various parts of the spinal cord, and form the protective structures necessary to enclose them. if the brain is in fact a spinal cord raised to its highest potential, it would seem probable that the bones enclosing it are also simply vertebrae that are more highly developed. Thus the entire head appears to be preformed in the bodily organs existing at a lower level. The forces active on a subordinate level are also at work here, but they are developed to their highest potential. Again, Goethe was concerned only with determining how this matter actually manifests in external reality. He said that he recognized this relationship very early on, in relation to the occipital bone at the back of the cranium, and the posterior and anterior sphenoid bones. But on his journey to northern Italy, when he found a sheep's skull that had burst open upon the dunes of the Lido, he recognized that the palatine bone, the upper jaw, and the intermaxillary are also modified vertebrae. The sheep's skull had fallen apart in such a fortunate way that the various pieces could be recognized clearly as individual vertebrae. On April 30, 1790, Goethe showed this beautiful discovery to Frau von Kalb and said, quote, "Tell Herder that I have come a whole formula closer to the animal form and its various transformations, and that through the strangest accident." Close quote. The significance of this discovery is very far-reaching. It showed that all members of an organic whole are identical in idea, and that inwardly unformed, in quotes, organic masses develop in different ways as they open up toward the outside. In other words, one and the same thing manifests at a lower level as spinal nerve, and on a higher level reaches out as a sensory nerve into the organs of the senses, which take in, grasp, and comprehend the outer world. Thus everything living was revealed in its capacity to form itself from the inside out as form-creating force. Only now could it be comprehended as a truly living entity. Goethe's essential ideas about the formation of animals had now also reached a conclusion. It was time to work them through, though he had planned to do this earlier, as shown in his correspondence with F. H. Jacobi. When Goethe followed the Duke into the Silesian encampment, Breslau, July 1790, he was busy studying animal morphology, and it was there that he began to write out his thoughts on the subject. On August 31st, he wrote to Friedrich von Stein, quote, "Amid all this commotion, I have begun to write my discourse on animal morphology." Close quote. In a larger sense, the idea of the animal type is contained in the poem, quote, "Metamorphosis of Animals," close quote, first published in 1820 in Goethe's second, quote, "Morphological Notebook," close quote. Between 1790 and 1795, Goethe primarily pursued his scientific research into color. At the beginning of 1795, he was in Jena along with the von Humboldt brothers, Max Jacobi and Schiller. Goethe presented his ideas on comparative anatomy to these friends, who found his presentations so significant that they urged him to write them down. Goethe's letter to the elder Jacobi shows that he immediately complied with that suggestion by dictating to Max Jacobi his Outline of Comparative Osteology. The introductory chapters were elaborated in 1796. These discourses contain Goethe's basic views on animal morphology, just as his views on plant morphology may be found in his, quote, "Attempt to Explain the Metamorphosis of the Plant," close quote. Footnote, this was the original title of Goethe's treatise, titled now The Metamorphosis of Plants, editor, end of footnote. Through his friendship with Schiller, begun in 1794, his views took a turn in that he now began to observe his own methods of research, thereby becoming conscious of his way of observing things. Footnote, Steiner's formulation is, and there's a German phrase, I'll give it a try, quote, "wobei ihm seine Anschauungsweise gegenständlich wurde," close quote. The original meaning of gegenständlich is, quote, "standing over and against," close quote. That is, becoming able to clearly observe something because one has gained the necessary distance from it. Through his acquaintance with Schiller, Goethe became able to observe his own way of thinking. In this sense, it became gegenständlich to him. editor, and a footnote. Having followed these historical developments, we will now consider the nature and significance of Goethe's views on the formation of organisms. The end of chapter 3.